attractive. They make sense of the random, the banal. It is much more palatable, for instance, to suppose that the President of the United States, the most powerful man on Earth, was murdered and history changed because of some vast and powerful group of evil men, than because one lone and inadequate paranoiac didn't feel good about himself and therefore felt the need to make a stab at personal significance. But if you have to work too hard to get a conspiracy theory to come together so all the pieces and connections fit, it's probably not authentic. Even simple conspiracies are difficult to pull off. People setting out to commit crime do not think in elaborate, step-by-step-by-step ways. Dr. Francis Tumblety. Francis Tumblety was born to a poor family in Ireland in the 1830s, the youngest of 11 children. While he was still a child, the family moved to Rochester, New York. From an early age, he was an energetic hustler, selling pornographic literature to canal boat travelers while still in his teens, then learning about medicines from a disreputable Rochester druggist. He ventured out into the world, beginning in Detroit, and set himself up as an herb doctor. Somehow he got people to fall for his claims, and he became rather well off. He would move from city to city as authorities recognized him as a charlatan. He began wearing elaborate uniforms, and during the Civil War moved to Washington, D.C., where he claimed to be a military surgeon and friend of President Abraham Lincoln and General Ulysses Grant. After the war, he traveled widely throughout the United States, getting in and out of trouble with the law. His personal life was shrouded in secrecy, though he was outwardly flamboyant, and at one point he was sued by another man for sexual assault. Many people who knew him believed he disliked and avoided women. On November 7, 1888, he came to the attention of the Metropolitan Police in London when he was arrested for gross indecency and indecent assault with force and arms against four men, beginning in July. Awaiting trial, he jumped bail and fled to France and then back to the States under the alias Frank Townsend. By the time he returned, American newspapers were already printing the rumor that London police suspected him of being Jack the Ripper. The rumor gained adherence when Inspector Walter Andrews, who was working on the case, was dispatched to New York, at which point Tumblety hastily quit that city, too. It was reported that Scotland Yard had requested samples of his handwriting. He dropped out of sight, then turned back up in Rochester, where he lived with his sister. He died in St. Louis in 1903. His considerable fortune was distributed to various nieces and nephews and several charities. Obituaries mentioned that he had been a suspect in the Ripper murders. A collection of preserved human uteruses was found among his possessions. In spite of this interesting finding, the fact that the murders stopped when he fled England, and all the contemporaneous speculation about him, I don't find Tumblety a serious suspect. He was apparently homosexual, and I do not believe he would have had the passion and frenzy for such destructive overkills and mutilation of the other sex. I also believe it unlikely that the man who perpetrated the Kelly murder could have gone on to a functioning life afterward without any outward signs of the depraved behavior. Tumblety was a con man, the exact opposite of the unsub I'd be looking for. His constant hustles and flights show Tumblety to be an organized, intelligent individual, and as I've mentioned, I believe the actual Ripper to have been someone who would not seek personal publicity. Again, just the opposite of Tumblety. There is also every indication that he was still in police custody awaiting bail at the time of the Kelly murder. Severin Klosowski and Neil Cream. Severin Klosowski was born in Poland, where he apprenticed in surgery. He came to England in 1887 and worked as a hairdresser and barber, ultimately in a basement shop on the corner of Whitechapel High Street and George Yard. But this was proven to have happened in 1890, after the final murder. He becomes a suspect because of this physical proximity to the murders and the fact that between 1895 and 1901, and now calling himself George Chapman, after the woman he cohabited with, who coincidentally shared the name Annie Chapman with the second Ripper victim, he poisoned three successive women with whom he had lived as husband. He was charged, tried, convicted, and executed by hanging in April 1903. Some contemporaneous evidence suggests that Inspector Aberline believed Klosowski Chapman to be the Ripper. We can discount this one relatively quickly, too. He is not a good match for any of the eyewitness accounts. Yes, he was in the area and, from his training, knew his way around the inside of a human body. But he was still hanging around and in business when the murders ceased. And he had relationships with women, which I do not believe the Ripper would have. He was organized enough to marry and dispatch three women in succession, though since he probably wasn't technically married to any of them, the profit motive doesn't really come into play here. Still, there is no way a man hacks apart five or six women, lies low for 10 years with no one noticing anything about him, then resumes his homicidal career as a poisoner, who, along with bombers, are the most cowardly and detached of all murderers. It just doesn't happen that way in real life. Other poisoners who have been suggested as suspects can be eliminated for similar reasons. Most prominent among these is probably Dr. Neil Cream, whose checkered career also included arson, blackmail, and illegal abortions. He was found guilty of the strychnine poisoning of four London prostitutes in 1892, so you can see why his name comes up. On the scaffold, as he was about to be hanged, he is reputed to have declared, "I am Jack the..." and then the trapdoor was released. As tantalizing as this is, we have another real problem with Cream, too. He is known to have been incarcerated at the Illinois State Penitentiary at Joliet from November 1881 into July 1891, so the American correctional system has given him his alibi. James Maybrick. Since 1993, anyone doing investigation into the identity of Jack the Ripper has had to come to grips with the possibility of James Maybrick. Though he had never been considered a suspect before then, in that year a book was published entitled The Diary of Jack the Ripper. It purported to show how a successful Liverpool cotton broker led a secret life as the Whitechapel murderer. Maybrick is an interesting case for another reason. He was allegedly the victim of murder himself by arsenic poisoning, for which his beautiful American wife was tried, convicted, and just barely avoided the gallows. By 1887, Maybrick's marriage to Southern belle Florence Elizabeth Chandler had become shaky. He had a mistress, and Flory had a lover. When his business started going downhill, in supposed punishment for her infidelities, he began beating her. He was also a hypochondriac who treated himself with arsenic, both for his health and as a sexual stimulant. In April 1889, Maybrick became ill. He died on May 11th. Flory became a suspect when a packet of arsenic was found in her room, and it was discovered that James had changed his will to cut her out. There were indeed traces of arsenic in Maybrick's corpse, but since he'd been self-administering the stuff for years, who could tell how it got there? Even so, Flory was put on trial. The judge was Sir James Stephen, whose son James Kenneth Stephen was a tutor to Prince Eddie at Cambridge and has become a minor Ripper suspect in his own right, partially due to his poetry demonstrating a rather severe paranoid hatred of women. At the time of the trial, Judge Stephen was practically senile and, by most accounts, completely mishandled the proceedings. After Flory was convicted, he sentenced her to death. The sentence was commuted, and after she'd served 15 years, she was freed. She returned to America in 1904 and lived until 1941. The evidence against James Maybrick as the Ripper is a 63-page journal written on the leaves of a Victorian photo album that was given to Michael Barrett, a Liverpool scrap metal dealer in 1991 by his drinking buddy Tony Devereux. Devereux died sometime after the transfer and, in any event, according to Barrett, said he knew little of the journal's provenance. The writer of the journal does not identify himself as Maybrick, but many references in the work demonstrate that it is his. The published book consisted of a photographic copy of the diary along with extensive background and commentary by Shirley Harrison, an author brought to the project by the British publisher. When the book hit the stands, it was hyped as, "The day the world's greatest murder mystery will be solved." Through Harrison and others, the diary has been subjected to a number of tests by handwriting experts, ink and paper specialists, and historians, with ambiguous results. Some say it is genuinely of the age, and others claim it to be an elaborate forgery. The handwriting does not match any of Maybrick's known exemplars, But some supposed experts have explained this away by saying that since the writer clearly suffered from multiple personality disorder, he would have had several distinct handwriting styles. I think this is bogus, but let's go on. The basic thrust of the diary is that the Ripper murders were caused by the writer's grief and rage over the infidelities of his wife, whom he thought of as a whore. He couldn't kill her, so he displaced that rage by killing actual prostitutes. Since a prominent Liverpool businessman couldn't do this in his own neighborhood, he'd go somewhere else during his business travels and do it there. Professionally, he frequented the area around Whitechapel Street in Liverpool, so he would carry out his murderous activities around Whitechapel Street in London. There's also some rather fancy stuff about the name Jack coming from the first two letters of James and the last two of Maybrick. The final entry reads, "I give my name that all know of me, so history do tell, what love can do to a gentleman born. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper, dated this third day of May, 1889. First of all, take my word for it, love can do a lot of things to a gentleman, but what the Ripper did isn't among them. A number of forensic factors suggest the diary is fake. There is evidence that much of the writing was done at only a few sittings, rather than episodically as an actual journal would have been. A Scotland Yard examiner stated that many of the handwriting flourishes appear to have been added after the writing was completed to make it look more authentically Victorian. Martin Fido, one of the experts called in to evaluate the diary before publication, found about 20 anachronisms in the text. Some of the descriptions appear to be based on newspaper accounts, rather than what was later learned to have actually taken place. Then there are certain crime scene issues. The writer speaks of a hideout on Middlesex Street, or Petticoat Lane. Yet why would the killer of Catherine Eddowes, clearly on the run from the police, flee from Mitre Square and past Middlesex Street to drop the bloody apron in Goulston Street, then return to Middlesex Street? It doesn't make sense. Even more to the point, how does a 50-year-old man with a family, children, and no sociopathology suddenly blossom into a disorganized serial killer? He can't and doesn't. Anyone who thinks his situation through enough to decide that he wants to kill prostitutes to get back at his wife, but must do so on trips to another city where he'll hide out, stalk women of the night, rip them up, and then return to his own world and home, would not exactly be disorganized. In fact, I've never seen one that organized. No one plans that carefully and then goes into such a frenzy of sexual pathology. And as we've said with other suspects, such as Joseph Barnett, even if he did, he wouldn't be able to return to normal life after that without someone recognizing something about his post-offense behavior. I have seen many diaries and writings of serial offenders. This one is noteworthy, not so much for what it doesn't get wrong, as for what it fails to reveal. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, and Arthur Bremmer, to name but three, all left extensive writings full of specific detail. If this diary were authentic, I would expect it to shed some new light on the crimes or their methodology, which is missing here. In a real killer's diary, I'd expect to see his whole pathological construct laid out, rather than just a simple and breast-beating excuse for why he has to kill these women. All of that is missing from the so-called Maybrick diary, which must be judged an elaborate fake. What did the police know? We could go into many more suspects here. There are scores of them. But none of the theories has enough going for it to be taken seriously, and they don't shed enough light on the investigative process to warrant the space. Was Jack, then, such an elusive, clever criminal genius? Not by any means. He knew the area, and he was lucky. The dark corners and back alleys favored by the lowest rung of prostitutes, who had no place indoors to go with their clients, were the same ones that facilitated a killer like Jack. Now it's time to review those individuals the police considered suspects. And as we do that, let me profile the police actions themselves based on the behavioral evidence they collectively left. Did the police have a good idea in the end of Jack's identity? They may very well have. The fact is, the major police effort, the tremendous expenditure of resources and manpower, stands down rather quickly after the murder of Mary Jane Kelly, more quickly than after the previous murders. We have already noted that the police were really under the gun, being subjected to massive public and press criticism and condemnation. Would they have risked another murder by easing up on their presence in Whitechapel? Knowing the way bureaucrats and public servants respond to outside pressure, it is difficult to conceive that they would. So, alternatively, we may speculate they had reason to believe that although the killer had not been captured and brought to justice, the reign of terror was over. So who at Scotland Yard might have known, or at least thought he knew? We have three main sources for this: the Macnaughton Memoranda, Dr., at this point, Sir, Robert Anderson's 1910 memoir, The Lighter Side of My Official Life, and the so-called Swanson Marginalia, actually Scotland Yard Chief Inspector Donald Sutherland Swanson's handwritten commentary in his copy of Anderson's book, which was released by his family after the 1987 publication of Martin Fido's book, The Crimes, Detection, and Death of Jack the Ripper. Sir Melville Leslie Macnaughton had been Assistant Commissioner in charge of Scotland Yard's Criminal Investigation Department, having joined as Assistant Chief Constable in 1889. We must therefore point out that his information would not have been first-hand, though he would have had access to all important information. The memorandum was written in 1894, and consisted of 7 pages written in his own hand, marked confidential, and placed in his files. He names 3 likely suspects. 1. A Mr. M.J. Druitt, said to be a doctor and of good family, who disappeared at the time of the Miller's Court murder, whose body, which was said to have been upwards of a month in the water, was found in the Thames on 31st December, or about 7 weeks after that murder. He was sexually insane, and from private info I have little doubt but that his own family believed him to have been the murderer. 2. Kosminski, a Polish Jew and resident in Whitechapel. This man became insane owing to many years' indulgence in solitary vices. He had a great hatred of women, especially of the prostitute class, and had strong homicidal tendencies. He was removed to a lunatic asylum about March 1889. There were many circs connected with this man which made him a strong suspect. 3. Michael Ostrog, a Russian doctor and a convict, who was subsequently detained in a lunatic asylum as a homicidal maniac. This man's antecedents were of the worst possible type, and his whereabouts at the time of the murders could never be ascertained. In his memoirs, Robert Anderson speaks of a lower-class Polish Jew whom he does not name, and states that the subject was caged in an asylum. The only person who had ever had a good view of the murderer at once identified him, but when he learned that the suspect was a fellow Jew, he declined to swear to him. This witness, Anderson mentions, is probably Joseph Lewendy, the cigarette salesman who was believed to have seen Catherine Eddowes with the Ripper at the entrance to Mitre Square. The Polish Jew in question would be Aaron Kosminski, the second name in the Macnaughton Memoranda. Kosminski was a hairdresser who moved to England in 1882. The records of the large Coney Hatch lunatic asylum, which would have handled most of the patients in and around Whitechapel, listed attacks of mental illness going back to 1885. By the late 1880s, he was known to wander about picking food scraps out of the street and would refuse food offered by anyone else. He would not wash and had at one point threatened his sister with a knife. From 1890 on, he essentially spent the rest of his life in asylums. In the margin of his personal copy of Anderson's book, where he talks about the Polish Jew and the witness who refused to ID him, Donald Swanson penciled, "Because the suspect was also a Jew, and also because his evidence would convict the suspect, and witness would be the means of murderer being hanged, which he did not wish to be left on his mind. D.S.S." He continues, "And after this identification, which suspect knew, no other murder of this kind took place in London." On the end paper he wrote, "After the suspect had been identified at the seaside home, probably the police convalescent home in West Brighton, where the suspect and the witness were apparently taken to get them away from the glare of London publicity, where he had been sent by us with difficulty in order to subject him to identification, and he knew he was identified. On suspect's return to his brother's house in Whitechapel, he was watched by police, city CID, by day and night. In a very short time, the suspect, with his hands tied behind his back, he was sent to Stepney Workhouse and then to Coney Hatch and died shortly afterwards. Kosminski was the suspect. DSS. The remaining suspects. When I was asked to participate in Peter Ustinov's television special in 1988 and offer a profile, I agreed with the understanding that I could only analyze the evidence, materials, and suspects presented to me. The suspects they presented were Robert Dunstan Stevenson, who often went by the name of Dr. Rosalind Dunstan, Montague John Druitt and Aaron Kosminski, two of Macnaughton's three suspects, Sir William Gull, the royal physician, and Prince Edward Albert, Duke of Clarence. The only one of these five we haven't mentioned so far is Stevenson, a self-publicizing con man who claimed to be a practitioner of magic. He was in Whitechapel at the right time and was known to be very interested in the Ripper murders, one time acting them out for startled onlookers. Since he was into witchcraft, these elements would surely have shown up in ritualized ways in the crimes. He would also have been able to bring his victims to a secure location rather than risking murdering them on the streets. Though the theory has its supporters, I have found nothing in his murky background that qualifies him as a good suspect. Prince Eddie and Gull we have already considered. So let's consider the remaining two here, Druitt and Kosminski, plus the third Macnaughton suspect, Michael Ostrog. Ostrog was an immigrant, probably from Russia or Poland, a known criminal, and possibly a doctor. He was too old and too tall to match the witness accounts. He was imprisoned in September of 1887, but transferred to Surrey Pauper Lunatic Asylum, where he displayed signs of insanity, probably faked, then released in March 1888. Since he was sentenced to prison for theft in Paris on November 18th, it's unlikely he was even in London at the time of all of the Ripper murders. He surfaces again in London in 1904, partially crippled, and living in the St. Giles Christian Mission. The police were definitely paying attention to him and were concerned during the murder series when he failed to report to them as directed. That he was in and out of mental institutions also probably had something to do with Macnaughton's interest in him, but again, I find nothing compelling in the facts we know to suggest that he might be the Ripper. Nothing else in his background suggests a propensity toward the type of savage violence we see in these crimes, and despite the mental illness, he seems too organized and together to fit the personality I'd be looking for. Which gets us to Montague John Druitt. Druitt is an interesting suspect primarily because of when he died. He was pulled out of the Thames on December 31st, 1888, and police estimated he'd been in there more than a month. His coat was weighted down with stones, and he had cash on him and two checks from the boys' school in Blackheath where he'd taught. They were probably severance checks, and the supposition is that he had gotten into trouble for sexual advances to some of the students. Though he has been described as a doctor, he was in fact a schoolteacher who was just beginning to make his way as a junior barrister. There was some mental instability and a history of depression in his family, and after his father died, his mother was placed in an asylum. I have always been a little surprised by the weight given to Druitt's candidacy as the Ripper. Aside from his untimely but convenient death, nothing really ties him to the crimes, including any known association with Whitechapel. There is no evidence of violence in his background, and a man doesn't just jump full-blown into the kinds of crimes we're talking about. But Aaron Kosminski looked good for the murders. A Polish-Jewish immigrant hairdresser with a history of mental illness and a reported dislike of women, he fit the eyewitness descriptions, the disorganized personality, and the police descriptions. The escalation of mutilation and depravity in the murders was dramatic, and the Mary Jane Kelly kill certainly strikes me as the work of a guy pretty much at the end of his mental rope. That is not to say that he'd turn himself in, as Edmund Kemper did, or kill himself. Rather, it suggests that he might not be able to continue functioning on his own much longer. And a guy who is so paranoid he eats garbage off the streets rather than accept food from anyone would tend to fit the bill. His is also the only name that comes up in all three of the key documents, though Anderson does not mention him by name. According to Swanson, when Kuzminski was placed under surveillance, the killing stopped. Though some have questioned the recollection of all three former cops, there is no compelling reason to think they were wrong in the essence of what they were saying. Martin Fido has extensively researched the lives and writings of all three men, and he states that everything else Robert Anderson wrote, on subjects far diverse from the Ripper murders, is accurate and creditable. So there is no reason to doubt him here. My subject, it will be noted, was an immigrant Jew, the very type many of the citizens of Whitechapel suspected, feared, and despised. Is his Jewishness a significant factor in either the profile or the commission of the crimes? No. Jack the Ripper had to be a poor East End local. A significant number of poor East End locals at that time were immigrant Jews. There are sick and murderous individuals in every definable race and ethnic grouping. That's it. Although Kuzminski seemed to fit my profile and evaluation, I cautioned on the show that 100 years after the fact, I could not prove that he was the actual killer. What I said was that Jack the Ripper would either be Aaron Kuzminski or someone like the man I was describing. And I stand by that. But as I learned in the years after the airing of the show, there are a couple of problems with Kuzminski, information I had not been given at the time. For one thing, Swanson turned out to be wrong on one critical fact. Kuzminski did not die shortly after the murders, but actually lived in asylums until 1919. During that time, he was often dissociative but not violent, and never gave any indication of being the Ripper. I would expect a paranoid individual of this nature to talk frequently of this. Kuzminski seems too docile and passive to have been a predatory animal nightly on the hunt for victims of opportunity. Re-enter Martin Fido. He had also believed that the man the police referred to as Kuzminski was the answer to the Ripper mystery, but the problems struck him as just as real as they did me. Knowing that the Polish Jew description from Anderson was more reliable than the name, Fido exhaustively checked the records of all the prisons and insane asylums in the area. And of all the names he went through, he came up with one fascinating candidate. David Cohen was a Polish Jew, 23 years of age at the time, exactly the same age as Kuzminski, whose incarceration at Coney Hatch fits precisely with the end of the murders. He had originally been brought by police to Whitechapel Infirmary on December 12, 1888, when they found him wandering at large and unable to take care of himself. Unlike Kuzminski, Cohen was violently antisocial and was kept in restraints. When he was given any clothing, he would rip it off his body. He spoke little, and when he did, it was a foreign language that attendants took to be German. Though we know he was in Whitechapel at the time of the crimes, we don't know where he lived or if he actually had a job. He became ill on December 28th, and while he gradually regained some of his strength during the spring and summer of 1889, he suffered a relapse and died on October 20th. The cause of death was put down to exhaustion of mania. This diagnosis, rather crude by modern standards, still fits in perfectly with the profile. The killer and mutilator of Mary Jane Kelly was at the end of his emotional rope. His address had been given as 86 Lehman Street, an unlikely possibility since this was the address of the Protestant Boys Club. However, Fido quickly discovered that number 84 was the temporary shelter for poor homeless Jews, which seemed completely logical. But this home only accepted newly landed immigrants for 2 weeks. Immigrant Jews taken in by their fellow immigrants in this way were often listed for employment in one of the traditional Jewish trades, either tailor or shoemaker. Cohen is listed as a tailor, but it is certainly possible that he had been a shoemaker. The connection of shoemakers with leather apron would have been enough to change the designation for his own protection. It's easy to see how 84 Lehman Street could be mistranscribed as 86, but how do you confuse Kuzminski and Cohen? Well, one possible way was explained to Fido. Cohen was a John Doe-type surname often given to Jewish immigrants whose actual surnames were difficult for Englishmen to pronounce or spell. It is therefore possible that the city police were following Kuzminski while Scotland Yard was following Cohen. The Yard knew their man had died, but weren't certain of his real name. The situation is further complicated by another fellow, generally referred to as Nathan Kaminsky, an immigrant Jewish bootmaker, the same age and general description as both Kuzminski and Cohen. He was treated for syphilis in a workhouse infirmary shortly before the murders, and then suddenly and inexplicably vanishes from the records. He lived right in the heart of the Ripper's comfort zone. There are no death records for him. So I think there is every chance that these three immigrant Polish Jews with documented emotional problems were combined and confused by the various police officials and agencies. I don't set much store in elaborate conspiracies and cover-ups, but I've seen enough bureaucratic gaffes and fumbles in my time to believe quite heartily in them. And yet, what is the element of truth or consistency that runs throughout the three accounts and also squares with the profile of the Whitechapel murderer? As we have seen, it's impossible to be certain of the true identity after all these years, but the behavioral evidence as to the type of individual he was is plentiful and compelling. Therefore, I'm now prepared to say that Jack the Ripper was either the man known to the police as David Cohen or someone very much like him. Chapter 2. Lizzie Borden. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. This is the way the most famous and notorious American murder case of the 19th century has chiefly been remembered. But if the unnamed authors of this rather cruel ditty were being responsible and accurate, they would have recast their verse into something less tuneful, yet somewhat more in line with the established facts of this officially unsolved case. An unknown subject took a hatchet and gave Lizzie Borden's stepmother 19 whacks. 90 minutes after that deed was done, he or she gave Borden's father 10 plus 1. The one being sufficient to cause death, the other 10 constituting out-and-out overkill. But as we'll discover, this was a behaviorally different type of overkill than what we saw in the Whitechapel murders. What was it about this brutal daytime murder in a small but prosperous New England town at the height of the Industrial Revolution that struck such a nerve not only in New England but, within days, across the nation and around the globe, just as Jack the Ripper had 4 years previously? For one thing, proper, well-to-do women just didn't get accused of cold-bloodedly hacking people to death. If the Whitechapel murders were about the potential for random brutality and the loss of public innocence regarding the presence of evil in a confident and complacent world, this case was about the potential for violence lurking within seemingly normal families, and the even more profound and searing loss of innocence that implied. It's difficult to avoid the interesting, almost uncanny parallels to another instance of officially unsolved, allegedly domestic murder that would take place 102 years later and an entire continent away. The killings of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman outside her condominium in the Brentwood section of Los Angeles in 1994. Both cases involved an upstanding, well-off community pillar defendant, represented by the finest legal team money could buy, who vigorously proclaimed innocence of the savage mutilation murders of one male and one female victim by bladed weapons that were not found at the scene. Nor had virtually any blood been found on either defendant. Both offered substantial rewards for information leading to the killer, rewards that were never claimed. And in both cases, the world was riveted to every word uttered in trial, during which each defendant chose not to take the stand to give her or his own account of what had happened. In fact, the only words both defendants uttered in open court were single sentences proclaiming their innocence. When people all over the world asked if a wealthy, famous, handsome, and charming ex-football star could possibly be capable of savaging his former wife and an innocent bystander in a fit of murderous rage? They were hearkening back to a similar question from the century past. Could a demure, well-mannered, and well-to-do former Sunday school teacher, active in her church and charities, and a prominent member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, actually be a monster? It was a question that, with individual variations, would be posed many times in the years between the two cases. It is, in many ways, the essence of criminological behavioral science. The Bordens of Fall River. Let's begin with the undisputed facts. At around 11:15 on the warm and humid morning of Thursday, August 4, 1892, Rufus B. Hilliard, the city marshal of Fall River, Massachusetts, received an urgent telephone call at the Central Police Station. It was from John Cunningham, a local news dealer. Cunningham happened to be at Hall's livery stable when he saw Mrs. Adelaide Churchill frantically approach her carriage driver, Tom, telling him to go find a doctor. Her next-door neighbor, Andrew Borden, one of the wealthiest and most prominent citizens in town, had been brutally attacked in the sitting room of his house on 2nd Street. Noticing Cunningham, she suggested that someone call the police, which is what Cunningham did, but not before he first called the Fall River Globe and gave them the exclusive story. The Borden family consisted of four members: Andrew Jackson Borden, one of the town's most prominent businessmen, 70 years of age, his second wife, Abby Durfee Grady Borden, 64, and Andrew's two adult unmarried daughters by his late first wife, Sarah Anthony Morse Borden, 41-year-old Emma Lenora, and Lizzie Andrew, 32. There was also a live-in maid, a 26-year-old Irish immigrant named Bridget Sullivan, who had been with the family for more than 2 years. In 1890, Fall River had a population of 80,000 and manufactured more cotton textiles than any other city in the world. And if one name could be associated with the economic origins and continued prosperity of the town, that name would be Borden. Though he was related to the family that had established Fall River and was by then enjoying its third generation of wealth, Andrew was only a second cousin of the wealthy Borden branch and had grown up without any of their power or advantages. His grandfather had been a brother of one of the original Bordens who made good, and Andrew's father had never made anything of himself. Everything Andrew had, and he had a lot, he'd earned completely on his own, beginning as a casket maker, then opening his own undertaking business, and investing the profits in real estate, banks, and mills. Now tall, thin, white-haired, and bearded, and almost invariably dressed in a heavy black suit regardless of the weather, Andrew Borden was president of the Union Savings Bank, a director of the Merchants Manufacturing Company, the BMC Durfee Safe Deposit and Trust Company, the Globe Yarn Mills, the Troy Cotton and Woolen Manufactory, and the owner of several farms. By 1892, his personal wealth was estimated as high as $500,000, a tremendous sum in those days. Probably as a result of his own struggle, Andrew was known as a fair but tough and hard-nosed bargainer in business, and in his personal life, he was parsimonious in the extreme, eschewing luxuries that were at this point commonly enjoyed by people with far less than he, such as electricity or indoor plumbing. The simple two-story frame house at 92 2nd Street was furnished with a water closet in the basement and slop pails in the bedrooms, which had to be emptied every morning. Andrew, who, according to all available research, had never been accused of a sense of humor, saw no reason for such amenities, much to the dismay of his daughters, who seemed to feel that their father's penurious lifestyle was prohibiting their chances for social success. On the morning in question, Emma was away from home, visiting friends in Fairhaven, some 15 miles away. But the household also had an overnight guest, John Vinicum Morse, 59 years of age, brother of Andrew's late wife. He had lived in Iowa for 20 years, but 3 years before had returned to the Northeast and resided in South Dartmouth. He arrived on the afternoon of Wednesday, August 3rd, then he left for one of Andrew's farms in Swansea. Normally the eggs from the farm were delivered to Andrew by the farmer on Thursdays, but Wednesday night Morse brought back with him the weekly egg delivery. Then Morse apparently discussed business details with his former brother-in-law. Though there is some suggestion the two men were talking about Andrew's intention to write a will, there is no documentation on this point. The Borden household, normally a rather dour place, would have been particularly unpleasant that Wednesday. At 7 in the morning, Abby had gone across the street to the home of Dr. Seabury Warren Bowen, complaining that both she and Andrew had been violently ill during the night with nausea and vomiting, and she was afraid someone was trying to poison them. After a quick exam, Dr. Bowen told her he did not think the illness was serious and sent her home. Later that morning, just to be certain, Bowen paid a call on the Bordens. Andrew ungraciously declared that he was not ill and had no intention of paying for an unsolicited house call. Since Andrew was as excessively thrifty with food as he was with everything else, the gastrointestinal upset had possibly been caused by the mutton stew the family had been having at various meals for several days in a row, despite the warm weather. Bridget, who was suffering some of the same symptoms, was convinced the stew had gone bad, but Andrew would not let her dispose of it. On Thursday, John Morse had breakfast with Andrew and Abby. Lizzie did not join them, which would have been normal. Despite living in the same small house, Lizzie seldom dined with her father and stepmother. Morse left the house at around 8:40 a.m., stopped at the post office, then went across town to see other relatives, the Emerys. Mr. and Mrs. Emery later reported that Morse had been with them between 9:40 and 11:20 a.m., and their impression was that after leaving them, he was headed home by way of New Bedford. Abby had directed Bridget to wash all of the windows, inside and out. This would have been a formidable task on any hot summer day, but it was particularly taxing this morning when she had already prepared and cleaned up after breakfast and was still feeling so ill. Around 9 a.m., she had to interrupt her work to rush outside to the yard to vomit. A few minutes later, Andrew left for his business rounds. Mrs. Churchill, the next-door neighbor on the north side, saw him leave. Bridget was still in the backyard being sick, and Abby was upstairs straightening out the guest room that John Morse had occupied. When Bridget came back in the house, she overheard Abby and Lizzie talking in the dining room. At a store he owned that was being remodeled, Andrew Borden told carpenters he didn't feel well and was going home, where he arrived around 10:40 a.m. He tried to open the front door with his key, but found it bolted from the inside with an additional lock, unusual during the day. So he knocked, and Bridget came over to open it. She had trouble springing the bolt, and according to Bridget, Lizzie was standing at the top of the stairs and laughed at her brief struggle. Andrew was carrying a small package wrapped in white paper. We do not know what was in this package. Since a burglary in the house the year before, he had kept his and Abby's bedroom locked, so he took the key from its place on the mantel and went up the back stairs. When Andrew returned downstairs, Lizzie told him that Mrs. Borden, she had some time ago stopped calling Abby mother, had received a note from a sick friend and had gone out. Still characteristically dressed in his tie and jacket, Andrew lay down for a nap on the couch in the sitting room with his feet resting on the carpet. So as not to disturb him, Bridget moved into the dining room and began on the windows there. Lizzie came into the room carrying an ironing board, which she set up and began ironing handkerchiefs. "Maggie, are you going out today?" Lizzie asked. Interestingly, Maggie was what Lizzie and Emma called Bridget, since that had been the name of the previous Borden maid. Apparently, the habit was too hard to break. Andrew and Abby called her by her actual name. Bridget replied, "I don't know. I might, and I might not. I don't feel very well." "If you go out, be sure and lock the door, for Mrs. Borden has gone out on a sick call, and I might go out too." "Miss Lizzie, who is sick?" Bridget asked. "I don't know. She had a note this morning. It must be in town." Bridget found this odd, since Abby, who was shy, plain, short, and overweight, normally told her when she was planning to leave the house, which didn't happen all that often. But Bridget accepted Lizzie's story. As Bridget was finishing up the dining room windows, Lizzie said to her, "There is a cheap sale of dress goods at Sargent's this afternoon at 8 cents a yard." This elicited a more enthusiastic response from the young woman, who declared, "I'm going to have one." She left Lizzie ironing in the dining room and went upstairs to her own room in the attic to rest for a little while, hoping to feel better. She lay down on top of the bedspread without taking off her shoes. It was too hot for a deep sleep, but she fell into a doze until she heard the city hall clock strike 11 a.m. She lay on the bed for another few minutes. At that point, she heard Lizzie calling urgently from downstairs, "Maggie, come down!" "What is the matter?" Bridget called back. "Come down quick! Father's dead! Somebody came in and killed him!" Bridget rose quickly and rushed down two flights of stairs. As she was about to head into the sitting room where Andrew had been napping, Lizzie said, "Oh, Maggie, don't go in." She then instructed her to go find Dr. Bowen. The crime scene. Mrs. Adelaide Churchill had been returning home after buying groceries when she saw Bridget Sullivan darting back in vain from Dr. Seabury Bowen's house across the street. She set her parcels down, then rushed over to the Bordens, fearing from Bridget's actions that someone was gravely ill. Lizzie was standing just inside the screen door on the side of the house, looking dazed. Mrs. Churchill called out to her, "Lizzie, what is the matter?" "Oh, Mrs. Churchill," Lizzie responded, "do come over. Someone has killed Father." The neighbor went around the fence and up to Lizzie. "Where is your father?" She had to ask several times before Lizzie finally responded, "In the sitting room." Mrs. Churchill went into the sitting room and beheld the carnage for herself. When she emerged moments later, she asked Lizzie where she had been when this happened. Lizzie replied that she had been in the barn behind the house, where she'd gone to find some iron to use as fishing weights for an upcoming trip. When she'd heard a noise, she had come out and noticed that the screen door was open. "Where is your mother?" Mrs. Churchill asked. Lizzie replied, "I don't know. She had got a note to go see someone who is sick. But I don't know, but she is killed too, for I thought I heard her come in." Then she offered, "Father must have an enemy, for we have all been sick, and we think the milk has been poisoned. I must have a doctor." At that point, Adelaide Churchill went out in search of Dr. Bowen herself, setting in motion the chain of events that summoned law enforcement authorities. As it happened, most of the Fall River Police Department was out at their annual picnic and clam bake at Rocky Point, Rhode Island. Hilliard dispatched George W. Allen, a young and relatively inexperienced officer, one of the few he had on hand. Meanwhile, Dr. Bowen had arrived, followed shortly thereafter by Bridget's return with Lizzie's best friend, Alice Russell. Bowen quickly went to the sitting room and came upon Andrew Borden's body. The corpse was half sitting, half lying on the sofa, the head resting on Borden's carefully folded coat, used as a pillow. His boots were still on his feet. The face was essentially unrecognizable. Blood spots were on the floor, on the wall over the sofa, and on the picture hanging on that wall. But the clothing was not disturbed, and there was no apparent injury to any part of his body other than the face. The most immediate concern of those in the house was Abby's whereabouts. Lizzie had reported her outing to a sick friend. With Abby's limited circle, the only one Bridget could imagine her going to see was her younger half-sister, Mrs. Sarah Whitehead. Bridget suggested that she go try to find Mrs. Whitehead, and if Abby was with her, to tell her only that Mr. Borden was very sick and she needed to hurry home. Then they could give her the horrible truth. Lizzie brought up again her suspicion that Abby had returned home, but if she had, then why hadn't she come downstairs when she heard the commotion? "Maggie," she said, "I am almost positive I heard her coming in. Won't you go upstairs to see?" That was the last thing Bridget wanted to do, fearing what she might find. "I am not going upstairs alone," she insisted. Mrs. Churchill said she would go with her, so together the two women climbed the stairs. When they got to the top, they could see her, lying face down in the guest room, propped on her knees as she had fallen. They raced back downstairs, where they found Lizzie now lying down. Alice Russell asked, "Is there another?" "Yes, she is up there," Adelaide Churchill replied. By this time, Officer George Allen had arrived at the Borden home, finding a house painter named Charles Sawyer on the street near the house. He enlisted Sawyer to guard the house while he went in to investigate. The front door was locked, so Allen moved around to the back, but was able to get in through the screen door on the left side near the rear of the house. When he got there, Dr. Bowen had already left to send a telegram summoning Emma home. Shaken by the grisly sight in the sitting room, Alan quickly searched the remainder of the first floor, then raced back to the police station and reported his findings to Marshal Hilliard, leaving Charles Sawyer guarding the residence. Other officers had returned to the station house, and Hilliard sent them out with Alan. By 11:45 a.m., seven police officers were in the Borden residence, along with Bristol County Medical Examiner William Dolan. Based on the comparative temperatures of the bodies, the condition of the blood on each, and an examination of the contents of the digestive systems, Dolan determined that Andrew had died at least 1 hour after Abby. Andrew Borden had been struck in the face. One eye was cut in half. His nose was severed, and 11 distinct cuts extended from the eye and nose to the ear. Fresh blood was still seeping from the wounds when he was found. Despite the severity of the attack, the clothing was not disturbed. The wounds were inflicted by a sharp, heavy weapon. He had been struck from above the head while he slept. The post-mortem exam on Abby Borden revealed that her head had been crushed, apparently by the same weapon that would kill her husband. One misdirected blow had struck the back of her head almost at the neck, cutting off a chunk of scalp. When her body was discovered, the blood was already dark and congealed. Abby Durfee Borden had also been hacked to death, suffering a total of 19 blows from a sharp-bladed instrument. As with her husband, the first blow was probably sufficient to cause death. Officer Michael Mullally asked Lizzie if there were any hatchets in the house. "Yes," she said, "they are everywhere." Later at the coroner's inquest, she testified that she did not know if there were any hatchets in the house. This was only the first of a number of troubling inconsistencies in Lizzie's responses. Bridget accompanied Mullally down to the basement, where he found four hatchets. One was a rusty, claw-headed hatchet. The second was dusty and appeared little used. The blade of a third one was covered in ashes and had all but a few inches of the handle broken off. From the condition of the wood fiber, the break appeared to be recent. A fourth bore the residue of dried blood and hair. About this time, John Morse came back, having been asked by Andrew to return for the noon meal. He strolled into the backyard where he picked some pears from the trees beyond the barn and spent several minutes eating them, apparently unaware of what was going on inside the house. Officer William Medley went to the barn and climbed up to the loft where Lizzie said she had been looking for lead to make sinkers for her planned fishing trip after she joined Emma in Fairhaven. He found the loft floor thick with dust and no evidence that anyone had been there recently. By this time, Dr. Bowen was back. He took Lizzie upstairs and gave her bromocaffeine for her headache and to calm her nerves. The next night, he administered the first of what would be a series of injections of sulfate of morphine as a tranquilizer. Alice Russell noted that while Lizzie was upstairs, she changed from the light blue dress she had been wearing to a pink and white outfit. Police found a small spot of blood on the sole of one of Lizzie's shoes and another small spot on one of her underskirts, about a 1/16 of an inch in diameter. It was consistent with human blood, and later laboratory examination determined that the saturation was more concentrated on the outside of the fabric than on the inside. This is important because Lizzie explained the spot as a flea bite, a euphemism at the time for menstrual blood, which was not discussed in polite society, even when speaking with the police. At 3 p.m., the bodies of Andrew and Abby Borden were carried into the dining room and placed on undertaker's boards like a folding table. Dr. Dolan performed autopsies there, where just that morning the two victims had had their breakfast. He removed and tied off the stomachs, which were sent by special messenger to Dr. Edward S. Wood, professor of chemistry at Harvard. Upstairs, Deputy Marshal John Fleet questioned Lizzie, asking her if she had any idea who could have committed the murders. She said that a few weeks ago her father had had an argument with a man she didn't know, but other than him, she couldn't think of anyone. Fleet then asked directly whether her Uncle John Morse or Bridget Sullivan could have killed her father and mother. She pointedly reminded Fleet that Abby was not her mother, but her stepmother, then said it would have been impossible for either Uncle John or Bridget to have committed the crimes. Emma returned from Fairhaven just before 6 that evening. The bodies of the Bordens were still in the dining room, awaiting the arrival of the undertaker. Sergeant Philip Harrington continued questioning Lizzie. Finally, the police left, cordoning off the house to keep away the curious who had assembled en masse. Bridget left to stay with Dr. Bowen's maid, while Emma and Lizzie remained in the house. Uncle John slept in the guest room where Abby had been killed, and Alice Russell slept in the warden's bedroom. Officer Joseph Hyde, on guard that night, reported that he saw Lizzie and Alice go down to the cellar with a kerosene lamp and carrying a slop pail. A few minutes later, Lizzie went down again by herself. He could see her bent over a sink, but couldn't tell what she was doing. Lizzie's story. On August 5th, an interview appeared in the Fall River Globe with another of Lizzie's uncles, Hiram Harrington, married to Andrew's only sister, Luana. The interview claimed that Harrington had spoken with his niece the previous evening, and that the reason she had not shown any emotion or grief was because she is not naturally emotional. This became a key issue. Lizzie had seemed to many observers to be emotionally flat, not the type of response one would expect from someone grieving for her beloved father, if not her stepmother. Now, we certainly look closely at this factor in criminal behavior analysis, but I am always wary of considering this subject in a vacuum, that is, strictly in and of itself. My several decades of experience in dealing with perpetrators, victims, and their families has told me that responses to horrible emotional trauma are very individual. It is true here, and it will be equally true when we consider the Charles Lindbergh Jr. and JonBenet Ramsey cases. It is in the nature of my work that I have been around many people who have lost loved ones to violent crime. Some of them, such as Jack Trudy and Stephen Collins, and Jean, Peggy, and Jenny Schmidt, will be familiar to our readers and have remained close friends. I have spoken with and spent time with others in the national spotlight who have suffered such loss, people such as John Walsh and Mark Klass, and I can tell you that the way a person responds to the unspeakable and unimaginable, whether it is by screaming to the heavens or essentially shutting down, is so private, so interior, that until you really know the individual in question, it is extremely risky to make judgments based on that response. So, if I were handling the Borden murder case, I would not, at this point, have been placing much store in Lizzie's emotional reaction one way or the other. But from a forensic perspective, there were a couple of highly problematic areas. The first was the timeline. Abby would have been killed around 9:30 in the morning. Andrew died a couple of minutes after 11 a.m. Did the killer hang around the house for an hour and a half, waiting for Andrew to return home? If so, where did he hide? The house was old-fashioned in design, without hallways, and only a few tiny closets. To get from one room to another, you went directly through a door to that room. Doors that the family did not want to be opened for privacy were kept locked with furniture up against them. So did the intruder listen for Bridget and Lizzie and whoever else might be home, and managed to stay out of their way for 90 minutes? If it was his plan to kill the elder Bordens, and no other motive is apparent, wouldn't he have staked out the home for a time when they would be there without Lizzie, Emma, and Bridget? Did he leave, and then return when he saw Andrew coming home and managed to get into the house a second time undetected? There was no sign of forced entry. In fact, Andrew himself couldn't get in until Bridget unbolted the door. Andrew Borden was wearing a gold ring, a silver watch, and had more than $80 in his pocket, all of which was undisturbed, nor was there evidence of anything having been taken from the house. Robbery or burglary were therefore unlikely scenarios. The most logical way around these problems, of course, was that there was no intruder at all. That made Lizzie and Bridget the prime suspects. Bridget's account was pretty straightforward. There was nothing much for the police to sink their teeth into. But Lizzie's story had some interesting details, holes, and inconsistencies, even if you discounted her supposedly inappropriate affect on learning of her father's and stepmother's murders. There was no indication that Abby had left the house at all that morning. Her half-sister Sarah Whitehead, the only one Bridget could figure she might go visit, turned out not to be ill or even out of town that day, and had not sent Abby a note. In fact, no one who knew Abby was ill, and none knew anything about a note. Police searched the Borden house but could never find one. Lizzie had told the police she had gone out to the barn shortly after her father returned home, which would account for why she hadn't seen the murder or become a victim herself. But depending on whom she spoke to, she had differing versions as to why she was there. One had to do with the lead sinkers she'd need for her planned fishing trip. She told Alice Russell she needed lead for a broken window screen she wanted to repair. Neither statement squares with Officer Medley's observation that the loft was so thick with dust that any footprint would have left a lasting impression. A corollary detail was equally troubling. The day before the murders, Lizzie had gone to Smith's drugstore, minutes from where she lived, according to the clerk, Eli Bence. She wanted Bence to sell her 10 cents worth of prussic acid, hydrogen cyanide in solution, saying she needed it to kill insects in a sealskin cape. Bence explained that he couldn't sell it to her without a prescription, at which point she said she became visibly annoyed and claimed she'd had no trouble purchasing it in the past. Lizzie denied having been at Smith's, though another clerk and a customer each identified her there between 10 and 11:30 in the morning. Later, another witness stated that Lizzie had tried to buy the poison from a different pharmacy on an earlier date. Saturday, August 6th. Was the day of the funerals for Andrew and Abby Durfee Borden. The service was conducted by the Reverends Edwin Augustus Buck and William Walker Jubb, both representing the town's Central Congregational Church. However, the burial at Oak Grove Cemetery did not take place as scheduled. The police had been informed that Dr. Wood wanted to conduct an examination of his own. So after the mourners had left the graveside, the undertaker brought the bodies back, after which the heads were removed and defleshed. Plaster casts were made of the skulls. Though untrue, it has long been said that for reasons undetermined, Andrew's skull was never returned to his coffin and that its whereabouts are unknown to this day. Actually, it was later reburied at the gravesite at his feet, as Abby's was buried at her feet. Another grisly sidelight to this grisly case. That day, Emma and Lizzie published their offer of a reward of the then enormous sum of $5,000 to anyone who may secure the arrest and conviction of the person or persons who occasioned the death of Mr. Andrew J. Borden and wife. That same day, after the funeral, Fall River Mayor John W. Coughlin and Marshal Rufus Hilliard informed Lizzie that she was officially a suspect. On Sunday morning, Miss Russell and Emma observed Lizzie burning a dress of blue cotton Bedford cord in the kitchen stove. "What are you going to do?" Emma asked. "I'm going to burn this old thing up," Lizzie replied. "It is covered with paint." Alice said, "If I were you, I wouldn't let anybody see me do that, Lizzie," then added, "I am afraid the burning of the dress was the worst thing you could have done, Lizzie." Lizzie replied curiously, "Oh, what made you let me do it?" And, "Why did you let me burn the dress?" The dress probably was, in fact, stained with paint. This was corroborated by others, but burning it was still odd at best. The Borden family was so frugal that they made rags out of clothing that could no longer be worn. Perhaps this was Lizzie's first conscious or subconscious act of defiance against that frugality. An inquest was held before Judge Josiah Coleman Blaisdell of the Second District Court, during which Lizzie testified. All testimony was kept secret. At this time, she was not yet represented by counsel, and as we shall see, this became a critical factor in her subsequent defense. She was formally arraigned according to a warrant drawn up by Marshal Hilliard. The grand jury indictment relating to her father asserted that Lizzie Andrew Borden of Fall River in the county of Bristol, at Fall River in the county of Bristol, on the 4th day of August in the year 1892, in and upon one Andrew Jackson Borden, feloniously, willfully, and of her malice aforethought, an assault did make, and with a certain weapon, to wit, a sharp cutting instrument, the name and a more particular description of which is to the jurors unknown, him, the said Andrew Jackson Borden, feloniously, willfully, and of her malice aforethought did strike, cutting, beating, and bruising, in and upon the head of him, the said Andrew Jackson Borden, diverse, to wit, 10 mortal wounds, of which said mortal wounds the said Andrew Jackson Borden then and there instantly died. And so the jurors aforesaid, upon their oath aforesaid, do say that the said Lizzie Andrew Borden, the said Andrew Jackson Borden, in manner and form aforesaid, then and there feloniously, willfully, and of her malice aforethought, did kill and murder, against the peace of said commonwealth, and contrary to the form of the statute, in such case made and provided. On Friday, August 12th, her prominent attorney, Andrew J. Jennings, declared before the court held at the police station, "The prisoner pleads not guilty." She was taken to the jail in Taunton, Massachusetts, 8 miles to the north, because Fall River had no facilities for long-term female prisoners. They'd never had the need. On August 16th, the bodies of Mr. and Mrs. Borden, minus their heads, were finally interred in Oak Grove Cemetery. And on August 22nd, 6 days of preliminary, or probable cause, hearings were held before Judge Blaisdell. Lizzie didn't testify at these hearings, though the record of her secret testimony for the inquest was offered into evidence. The murder weapon was still a problem, and remains one. After completing his examination, Dr. Edward Wood testified that he could find no human blood or tissue on any of the hatchets from the Borden basement, and that the blood and hairs noted on one axe were from a cow. That fact notwithstanding, at the end of the hearings on September 1st, Judge Blaisdell rendered his judgment, which is worth examining for its pained but resolute logic. "The long examination is now concluded, and there remains but for the magistrate to perform what he believes to be his duty. It would be a pleasure for him, and he would doubtless receive much sympathy if he could say, 'Lizzie, I judge you probably not guilty. You may go home.' But upon the character of the evidence presented through the witnesses who have been so closely and thoroughly examined, there is but one thing to be done. Suppose for a single moment a man was standing there. He was found close by that guest chamber which, to Mrs. Borden, was a chamber of death. Suppose a man had been found in the vicinity of Mr. Borden, was the first to find the body, and the only account he could give of himself was the unreasonable one that he was out in the barn looking for sinkers, then he was out in the yard, then he was out for something else. Would there be any question in the minds of men what should be done with such a man? So there is only one thing to do, painful as it may be. The judgment of the court is that you are probably guilty, and you are ordered committed to await the action of the Superior Court." On November 7th, the grand jury began 3 weeks of consideration of the case of Lizzie Andrew Borden. When Prosecutor Hosea M. Knowlton completed his presentation, he invited Jennings to present a case for the defense. This was a great surprise, unheard of in Massachusetts. In effect, the two attorneys were conducting a trial before the grand jury. For a time, it looked as if charges against Lizzie would be dismissed. There were no eyewitnesses, no clearly identified murder weapon, and questionable motive. The key circumstantial piece of the case against her was that she had the proximity and best opportunity to have committed both murders, and no other scenario was nearly as intellectually satisfying. Then on December 1st, Alice Russell testified about the burning of the dress. The next day, Lizzie was charged with 3 counts of murder, of her father, of her stepmother, and of both of them together. The trial was set for June 5th, 1893. Altogether, Lizzie was in Taunton jail for 9 months before that date arrived. The trial. Emma and Lizzie Borden had inherited their father's estate, so together they had plenty of money and lined up the best defense that money could buy. In addition to Andrew Jennings, they hired a 42-year-old Boston attorney named Melvin Ohio Adams. Adams had been an assistant district attorney and was a specialist in criminal prosecution. And the key to the defense team was the Honorable George Dexter Robinson, 59, former senator, congressman, and governor of Massachusetts. In the small world department, or possibly the conflict of interest department, depending on your point of view, while governor, Robinson had appointed Justin Dewey, one of the trial's 3 presiding judges, to the Massachusetts Superior Court. Emma and Lizzie paid Robinson the monumental sum of $25,000 for her defense, roughly 5 times what judges were paid annually. It has been asserted that Robinson would not agree to take the case until he was convinced of Lizzie's innocence. At their first meeting, he advised Lizzie to start wearing black. If convicted, he informed her, she could face a sentence of death by hanging, although no woman had been executed in Massachusetts since 1778. This is just one of many precursors to other cases and trials we see acted out with Lizzie Borden. I can't tell you how many times I've seen a suspect right after his arrest and then compared that to the way he looked in court months later. He's cleaned up, cut his hair, wearing a conservative suit, with an intense, pensive, and vulnerable look in his eyes that says to the jury, "This fine young man couldn't possibly have done the hideous things you've heard described." Sometimes, when I'd walk into court and glance over at the defense table, I couldn't tell which was the defendant and which the attorney. To assist Hosea Knowlton for the prosecution, Massachusetts Attorney General Arthur E. Pillsbury appointed 40-year-old William Henry Moody, the district attorney for Essex County, who would be appearing in his first murder trial. Moody would go on to a career as a congressman, secretary of the Navy, U.S. Attorney General, and Supreme Court Justice. Shortly after the trial, Knowlton replaced Pillsbury as Massachusetts Attorney General. On May 31, 1893, 5 days before the scheduled start of the trial, an unexpected event, astounding in its proximity to the trial and profound in its implications, occurred in Fall River. Stephen Manchester, a dairy farmer, came home from his milk deliveries to find his 22-year-old daughter Bertha lying beside the black iron stove in the kitchen, hacked to death. Defense wounds and rips in her clothing suggested she had put up a fierce struggle with her assailant. Stephen and Bertha had lived alone in the farmhouse, both of his previous wives having left him, reportedly because he was both cheap and mean. Dr. William Dolan again conducted the autopsy and described 23 distinct and separate axe wounds on the back of the skull and its base, very similar to the wounds inflicted upon the back of Abby Borden's head.